I will be talking with Marguerite Sheffer. She wrote The Man in the Banana Trees. This collection of short stories is definitely like one of my favorites, and it's fun because I've been rereading some of them. It came out in 2024, so I've been rereading a few leading up to this, and there were little things that I forgot, so I'm excited to talk to Maggie about them. Like I said, this one came out in 2024. It's the Iowa Short Fiction Award. It was named the best debut book of 2024 by Debutiful and a most exciting debut story collection by Electric Literature. It was also a finalist for the 2025 Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize. Her short fiction has appeared in Asimov Science Fiction, Epiphany, Bomb, Lit Hub, and many others. At Tulane University, she teaches courses in design thinking and speculative fiction as tools for social change. And I want to talk about what design thinking is because I was like, I'm in. I don't know what, but I need more details. So if y'all have any questions during the show, just type them in the comments and we will answer them in real time during the event tonight. And without any further ado, let's welcome Maggie Sheffer to Book Banter.
Yay! Hey, Raina. Thanks for having me.
Hello. Thanks for joining me. I was saying before we went live, I was like, I don't know why we haven't done this already. As soon as I like received your email and I was looking at it, I was like, yeah, obviously. What was I thinking before? I wasn't. That's what happened. So I want to go back to start like with this bio because I really am interested. Like, what is design thinking?
Yeah, so I came at design thinking in a really sideways way, but my understanding of design thinking is that it is a creative, human-centered approach to solving problems, meaning rather than saying, okay, I'm a genius and I have the best idea ever and I'm not going to get any feedback on it and I'm going to jump straight into production. Instead, it flips that on its head and it says, start small, but think really wildly and creatively and run lots of little small scale experiments. You've probably heard of brainstorming, right? Authors and writers, we know about brainstorming. Brainstorming, prototyping, these are techniques that share the design thinking world. And I think what I love about design thinking as a fiction writer is it helps me fight my perfectionism because it can be so intimidating to get started. And if I'm worried about making a clean, neat, tidy, you know, palatable story, I don't get to the exciting, messy parts. But design thinking encourages me to let that first draft be totally wackadoo and get feedback and go from there and acknowledges that it's a really messy process. So I do think there's a lot of connections between the design thinking world and the fiction world, but they're theoretically pretty separate.
Well, and now that you have described this, I completely understand why you teach it. Because in reading your stories, they do a lot of them. It's like, okay, here's the regular world that we live in. And now, but what if, and we could just talk about like, this is the first one in the collection. What if a Muppet / puppet just went to regular high school? What happened? Right. And this design thinking idea, like you say, you just lets you kind of like go off of the rails. You can just go everywhere with this. And then you come back and you go, okay, where do we make it make sense to put in the book?
That's exactly right. Letting it go off the rails. In the design thinking world, we talk about like expanding the creative space to embrace more bad ideas. Because I think that's how you get to the really surprising and interesting ones rather than the safe ones. I think one thing I've had to learn the hard way about creativity, at least my brand of it, is that it's not having a good idea. It's actually having higher tolerance for bad ideas and just like sitting with them and not trying to shut them down and lowering that filter as much as I can to just kind of sit with bad ideas and juggle them around for longer.
And I feel like sometimes with writing especially, but with other things as well, it's like just get it out and put it on the page. Like even if you're just making a pro con list or, you know, a list of certain things, it's just like, just put it down. Don't edit yourself before you get it out of yourself, put it on the page, and then you're like, okay, this one's too far. That one's never going to happen. Or, you know, but if you edit yourself in your head and you don't get it out in some way, it is never really lived at all. Like it was never really an option.
Totally. I so agree with that. And I'm the number of drafts I go through to write even a flash fiction story, like I'll write thousands upon thousands of words to try to eventually get to a tight 1K or under. But it's not like the first draft even resembles the last one. It has to go off the rails for a while to find what it wants to be. I think that's so well put.
Yeah, just let it. One of like the best writing, I don't know if it's vices, but exercises that I ever did, and it was in high school, is the first time it was ever like introduced to me, my 10th grade English teacher, and it was just stream of consciousness. And she would have us do these, I think like once a week. Like, I don't know if, I don't remember it being like every Friday, but I do remember like it was a lot. And sometimes she would give us prompts and sometimes she wouldn't. And we would turn the page in, but she's like, I'm not even looking at, I'm not going to read this. I just want you to fill at least a page.
Yep.
Like, and that really just freed you up as a student to write whatever. So you didn't, you know, I'm in high school, so I don't want my English teacher, you know, an adult to know something, right? Because she's like, I'm not grading it for that.
Yeah.
And it didn't, since it didn't matter, you took all of those like school sort of things away from it and these right. judgments away from it, whether that was grammar or content. I just by, you know, after the third or fourth one, we're doing them. And I was like, I love this because it did. I didn't want to stop because it felt like by the end of the page or whenever she would say, okay, turn it in. I had just gotten to something that I wanted to write about.
Yep. Yeah. I actually used to be a high school English teacher and I would do that. I'm a big fan of the morning pages from The Artist's Way. So a similar idea. I do them whenever I can these days with two kids. But I used to make my high school students do that when they were seniors. And some loved it and some did not love it so much. But
I can see it. Well, and I'm such a rule person. Like I thrive in an environment where someone's like, here's the fence, just stay in here. And I'm like, yes. I know what to do now. And it was like this, like almost like a breaking the rules, but I was allowed to. And that was mind blowing to me. And so that's still something that I do a lot of times when I'm stuck in writing, but stuck in stuff,
yeah.
You know? And it's just like, it's become sort of journaling in some ways, but even then sometimes I'm like policing my own journaling. I'm like, no, just stop that and fill this page.
What do historians say when they find your papers?
You know what's wild? Like during COVID, and that was the time when everyone was like, well, write it all down, right? This is history. This is happening. I wrote so little, like journal, anything, because I don't know whether it was the stress or like literally the pressure. Like that was the one time when everyone was like, this is important. And I'm like, oh, well, I got nothing. Then I got up, I was stressed out. I took a nap, whatever, you know, it was weird, but I can't wait to one day. There are probably these amazing COVID journals, right? That will come out and they'll be brilliant or they'll be just somehow this person had all the time in the world, but found this amazingly nuanced way to enjoy their time. I don't know, but I'm looking forward to that, but it wasn't me.
There's a great example of this. I'm going to misquote it. I saw it on social media, so this is like fourth hand, but a little kid was writing her diary and it was all about like her new shoes, blah, blah, blah. First man on the moon. I have a crush on Jamie. But like in the background is a man landed on the moon. But like, just like four words. And then, you know, her school friend's life and all this, you know, kindergarten drama gets pages and pages and pages.
Of course. But that's perfect. See, that's a brilliant way to work in, you know, what's going on in the world and how other people are just glued to the TV. And she's like, look, I was happening over there. Mom was watching it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's important what's going on over here.
Yeah.
Did you see that coloring page? It was awful.
Exactly. What I had for dinner, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Well, and it is like, you know, to a 4 or 5 year old, it's more important that we had lasagna or pizza than it is that I don't even know what's happening on the TV. That's not real.
Yeah, exactly.
People are like, what's that? Well, what even is that? So when when people write like short story collections and poetry collections, especially, these are two that is always fascinating to me, like how many completed pieces did not make it. Because when it's a novel, it's usually not a completed piece that didn't make it, right? It's bits that are maybe edited out. Yeah. But when you're talking about a short story collection or a poetry collection, I am sure there are some that were like, no, this isn't going to make it.
I have a multi-part answer to that question. One, I have many failed stories where I just tried to write them and they never got off the ground and they're not fit for human consumption. Maybe I'll go back to them someday, but they're just kind of false starts. So I have drawers full of those. This book was published by winning a contest that I was totally unprepared to win. And I literally put in pretty much every story I had ever written to date or finished, to make the minimum page count to submit. I took out one, that was a young adult fiction story, which I love, but it didn't quite fit. It was kind of clearly for a different audience and it had a different vibe. It's the only young adult fiction story I've ever written, which is so fun to do. Mm-hmm. But it just didn't quite fit in there. So I took out that one. But other than that, it was literally every story I had ever finished at the time.
Wow.
Order, and I sent it away and then I didn't think about it again because I did not think I was going to win.
Okay, so is that the first one that you submitted to? I mean, since you were like...
The first one I submitted to. I got rejected by a few others that I submitted to after, before I heard from this one. But it was, in fact, the first one I submitted to. Crazy, yeah. Right? And I was so thrilled. I submitted to it before I felt ready because the judge, Jamil John Koshai, is one of my absolute favorite writers. Yeah, I can see your face. He's amazing. and he was the judge and I was like, well, I have to send it this year, even if I'm not ready because he's so wonderful. So,
but turns out it was ready. You just see, it was perfect because we would have overthought it. You would have added other things and taken things out and this is perfect. So it was ready. It was the right time.
Just goes to show I'm not a very good judge of what will, you know, do well in the world. I just have to write and then shoot my shot.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what you do anyway, to some degree, especially when it's your own work. I feel like you can know when you feel like it's finished and you can kind of know it's better and worse, you know, but anyone who's like, yes, this is the best thing I've ever done here. You are definitely going to love it. I'm like, okay, buddy.
I've been there. I've been that person many times and it has not. Yeah. Those are never the things that end up going well.
I hear you.
It's a strange thing where you're like, who will like this? I'm just going to, you know, it's so weird, too personal, but that ends up being, I think something about that specificity or that strangeness is actually what people end up enjoying, you know, mm-hmm. Something where you're like, nobody's going to like this, you know?
Well, then it's always like, it, no matter to what degree, like, you know, it is accepted or enjoyed by someone, it's always kind of a little surprising then if you're sending it out, like, I don't know. And then someone's like, oh, I like it. That's great. Or someone's like, you've won the biggest prize ever. That's also great. But like anywhere in there is good because you're like, I don't know.
Right. So. I think, yeah, all we can do is make stuff that we really love and vibe with and then, you know, see what happens next.
See what happens. Okay, so we have a question. How often do you go back to your old ideas to mine? Like, I'm assuming to mine them, yeah.
It's a great question. Pretty frequently. I have these blue journals. They're right here, so I'm going to pull one out. Ooh. That I do my morning pages in. And I'll write down, if I think I have a banger idea, I'll like mark it in the margin. And I will go back to those. And I'll skim them. And that includes like story fragments or metaphors or images or like premises I couldn't figure out how to make work at the time. But I will go back. The novel I'm writing now, a lot of the drafting was actually done in those notebooks. So later on, I have to find them and retype them. In terms of older story ideas, one of the stories in the collection, the one that's called The Observer's Cage, was actually born out of the wreckage of a really failed story. It was originally called Moonburn, and it was about astronomers and it was a romance. And I just could not, I could not get it. I tried many different ways over a couple of years and I put it away and I would come back to it. And then in the process of struggling and failing to write that story, I went to the New Orleans Public Library and I got a giant textbook on the history of astronomy. And I just started turning to random pages every morning. And then one of those pages happened to be a photograph with a caption. And it was a photograph of the woman who discovered pulsars, but was not awarded the Nobel Prize for her discovery. Mm-hmm. And then I read up a little bit on her. And then I quickly shut the book because I didn't want to know anything else. I had the germ of the thing and I didn't want facts to get in the way. But that's kind of an example of, like, it's rarely ever a straight line between an old idea and a new project. But I do find it fruitful to kind of pick up that thread and, with the years of different thoughts and ideas, go back to it and see what's new about an old idea.
Yeah. Oh, I love that idea too. Like you knew kind of where you wanted to be, like the world, the astronomy, right? You knew the world you wanted to be in. So you're like, well, let me just go get a textbook. Let me go find, you know, there'll be something that'll be inspirational. That's amazing. I love that.
I just knew I didn't have the thing. So it had to be somewhere. I just, you know, whatever it was, it wasn't in my brain. So I wanted to get it jogged by something else. So I still have that old draft. Maybe Moonburn will live again, but I'm really proud of the Observer's Cage. And it kind of came from like cheating on the story I was supposed to be working on. It's a new story. Like, you know what, I'm going to write this. And then it blossomed into a story I'm really proud of.
That's great. It's like, it's not you, it's me.
Right.
It's me, old story. It's fine. This is just a little, you know, a little younger, a little shinier, a little more interesting. That's good.
Yeah.
They also said, like, on second look, how often on second look it wasn't as awful as you remembered. So,
question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. I mean, I've definitely written things that are cringeworthy. That's a real, real reaction I have to my own work sometimes. It's, ooh. But I will say, I think that putting things in the drawer rather than just struggling with them is really helpful. And for me, that can be many times or many years. A lot of the stories in this collection, even if they were incredibly short, took a lot of time where I had to step away from them and work on something else and then come back to them. And I will say, maybe it's not that they weren't as awful as I remembered, but suddenly I had clarity on like, oh, that's the problem, right? Like, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. Or even something had happened in my life or in the news where I was like, oh, that's the missing, you know, X factor or ingredient that could really bring this back to life. And I think if I had sat there at the desk years ago, just like trying to blunt force my way through, I never could have found that thing. I couldn't think my way there, but letting it rest and going on and living life and working on other projects and practicing my writing. Usually when I come back, it's like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. So that's like, just sometimes just, yeah, getting up and walking away.
Yeah.
I just, in trying to get work done every day, like emails or creating graphics or just the endless to-do list, I find that I definitely work better or more productively if I do, like, maybe every half hour I gotta get up from the desk and walk away. It doesn't work if I stay here doing something else on the computer, then I'm just doing the same thing. I gotta get up, walk away. It could be another chore, honestly. If I'm at home, it could be the laundry, but it can't be at the desk.
That thing you just said about another chore, I get that entirely. And I think that does carry over into writing, but I'm so resistant to doing what I ought to be doing that I can, if I'm supposed to be cleaning, I'll write. If I'm supposed to be writing, I'll clean and I'll feel so happy about that. Like I'm getting away with something. But that often comes up in my fiction writing work too, of like, I'm often not doing the project I'm supposed to be doing career-wise, but I have never regretted that choice because usually that thing I'm not supposed to be doing ends up being something that I'm really excited about because it feels free and lower stakes. And then, you know, it's not like for public consumption at the time I'm playing with it. It's just for me. And having that little protected time when it's like cheating on my main project is actually really special.
Yeah. Well, and it's similar to that. We've been given, you kind of have this little fence, but you're going to play in inside of it. It's fine. As long as you're sort of just playing around inside of it. It's, you're supposed to be writing a story, but you're kind of writing this other story. And that's fine because you're in the same little thing here. It's good.
Word count, writing.
Word count, yeah. We're doing 1,000 words a summer every day. It's fine. As long as you hit that mark, you're good to go. Who cares what it was? It was brilliantly worded email. That's what I'm writing. So how long did it take you to write the stories that are in this book? Then, since you were writing them, but not for a book or to collect them, really.
They were each standalone experiments. It took me from 2020 till 2023. So in 2023, I submitted the collection. And in 2020, I was starting the very first stories.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then what? So what happened then? Were you were writing before that? Were you writing something else? Were you not writing short stories? What were you doing? Tell me more.
Not writing. So I was, I loved writing and reading, but I was a high school English teacher for about 10 years and then teacher coach for a while. Some people managed to make it work, but I never found a way to write while I was teaching. It was always kind of like, I want to write in the summer. I want to do in the afternoons, but I was always so happily involved in teaching. It was really fulfilling and wonderful. But I really, really didn't write from college until 2020, which I'm old. For me, it was a long time. But in 2020, when COVID hit, my job got majorly COVID-ed. So I suddenly had no commute and some money saved up and a lot of time. And I'd always told myself that writing and really going back to get an education in writing, because I really love being a student. Can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
Was the thing I would always wanted to do. And it kind of called my bluff. I know COVID was tragic in many ways, but for me, I wouldn't be writing really if COVID hadn't hit, probably. It really forced me to reevaluate what I was wanting to do with my time and my life on earth. So I went and I did a low residency MFA program, because our local fave, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, teaches at that program at Randolph MFA, and he's amazing. And he said it was a really special place, and he was right. So I went back and I did that starting in 2020. So we were on Zoom initially.
Yeah. Okay, that's fascinating. I either didn't know that or have completely forgotten it.
Yeah.
So.
But sure, I did not. Yeah, I came to writing really just, I finished my first short story in 2020.
Amazing. Well, okay, I agree with you on COVID. Like, obviously, it's wildly awful. Yeah. But at the same time, I think for all of us, to some degree, it did make you stop and look at your life.
Yeah.
Whatever that meant for you. But it did. It was the shift in, like, everybody.
Yeah.
Did it.
Yeah.
And so I think that even though I didn't career shift, do any sort of major shift like that, that's visible out here.
Yeah.
I look at everything differently.
Yeah.
I look at everything differently. And it's not just like when someone coughs next to you on the sidewalk. It's
right.
It is like, it makes me think like, okay, so I'm on this path now. If COVID hit again, if something like that happened, would it be cool? Am I okay with this? Mm-hmm. Is this the path would I stay here? And if I wouldn't, then maybe this is not what I'm supposed to be doing, so it did make me like reevaluate decision making, especially and those bigger things that are big, like life things, is this what I want to be doing?
Yeah. And the generation of young people that were coming of age during that, I mean, they suffered a lot losing the education, but I so admire their lack of trust of institutions, because that's been way harder for me to, I'm still digesting that pill as a 30-something, late 30-something. But the young people I work with, they've really got that priority straight of like, I'm going to live my life and not wait for paychecks or institutions to tell me exactly how to be, because those things abandoned them right when it counted, right? Yeah. The adults did not have a plan.
Yeah, that is so true.
Yeah.
Like my son just started college this year. Mm-hmm. So COVID hit in middle school for him. And it was right when he should have started like going over to friends' houses and like taking those extra steps. He had just started, like he went to Willow. And so he had just started like walking down to the Starbucks there. And then we would come pick him up like maybe an hour later. So he had a little bit of time. And so he had just started doing that. And didn't get to do those next steps. So right. They it's so hard. And you're absolutely right, though. Then when they were like, oh, no, come on back into the building, like in a year or so later, he was like, are you kidding me?
Right.
No, like, I don't trust anything any of y'all are telling me.
Right.
And it's fair because it as a parent at that point, too, it was like, I want to be like clear and honest about what I know, but also I don't know either. And that's a kind of a scary moment as a parent, because you're supposed to be like, okay, give me a day. I'm going to come up with a plan, then I'll come present it to you. And then it's like, there isn't one. I don't know. We're just going to stay inside and wait. Is that giving you, is that helping you feel supported? I'm doing my best.
Yeah. Working in education, it was a real, the emperor has no clothes kind of moment. It was like, they're the systems we thought were foolproof are bullshit. Like, don't roll, and you know?
Yeah. Well, and then as a teacher too, like, you're in this position of authority. So I'm sure there's students asking you what's going on. There's parents asking you what's going on. They don't know. You don't know. You're asking the administration. They don't know. They're asking officials. They don't know. Everyone is just like, look, if we could just stop going outside, we'll figure it out. Like, all right. Right. Sounds simple.
Yeah.
Sounds simple. But we got this. We got this out of it. And you mentioned the novel you're working on.
Yes.
What?
Should I tell you about it?
You should tell me about it. It's perfect timing.
Right now, yeah. I'm happy to talk about it. It's tentatively titled Egret, and it's historical speculative fiction, and it's set locally around the turn of the century, so like 1896 to like 1903-ish. And gosh, I'm having so much fun writing it. It involves a female reporter who's kind of modeled after a real woman named Catherine Cole. I don't know if you're familiar with her at all, but she really was a female reporter for the Picayune. Fascinating lady. She's heavily fictionalized and goes to report on the declining egret population, because at the time, egret feathers were worth as much as gold by weight. So egrets are swiftly disappearing. And early environmentalists are saying, no, please don't kill all the egrets. And there's something called the plume wars happen, where there's this big fighting. But anyway, that's kind of the setup in which the story starts. But this female reporter goes to a mysterious island and discovers some dark secrets and has to make some hard choices after that. But I'm having a lot of fun writing it.
And the plume wars part, that's the true part, right?
Yes, that's okay. Very real.
One thing I love about historical fiction is that it is almost always the thing you're reading and you go, but that's not true. And when you Google it, that's the part that's real. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And I love it.
Yes. Isn't that cool? The Plume Wars. And I'm having a lot of fun doing research and reading old issues of the Picayune, which you can find. And the reporter who I mentioned, Catherine Cole, her papers are housed at Tulane. So I can like walk across the quad nice. And go, like, touch the actual papers that she wrote. And she's a phenomenal writer. So it's really beautiful stuff. Anywho, it's a blast. So hopefully that book will see the light of day someday. But yeah. I'm a very slow writer, so I hesitate to promise anything.
No promises necessary. Eventually, we get to it, and now we all know to Google the Plume Wars and learn about that, the actual history.
Maybe that should be the title, The Plume Wars.
Oh, I'm in. I'm in either way. I want to read it, so we're good. And then I know that it's
come to you, Raina.
Yeah. I am here. I will read it. I will read it early. I will blurb it. I'm in. I would love to read it and share it for sure. Okay, everybody. Thank you for watching. I'm going to put the link to buy a copy of The Man in the Banana Trees. So you can grab a copy from Book Banter Books. So I'll get it to you. I can even get it signed. That would be amazing. I know. I know people who know people who can get it signed. thanks for watching. Thank you for commenting. And Maggie, thank you for joining me for Book Banter.
Thank you for having me. I love the show. It was so fun to be here.
Absolutely. All right. Have a good night, you guys.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Book Banter with Raina. I have been your host, Raina Nielsen. Theme music and production assistance was provided by Hoodoo Phonics Productions.